Hello, listeners. You're about to listen to one of our BooTubes. BooTubes are episodes that we typically release on Patreon, and they cover a TV show, but basically similar format to our regular episodes, except about a TV show instead of a movie. For this one, though, because we had such a special guest, Lenny Duncan, returning to talk about their new book, Dear Revolutionaries, we thought we would release it on the main feed so everyone can listen to it. Just a note though, the sound quality is not the best because of where we were recording the locations. There are some outdoor recording, there are some indoor recording, there are some not great internet bandwidth stuff. So please bear with us for this episode. But other than that, without further ado, here is BooTube number 13 on Lenny Duncan's book, Dear Revolutionaries, and the Apple Plus TV show, The Foundation. Please enjoy. Greetings, everyone. You're listening to Horror Nerds at Church, a ridiculously queer podcast where we take a deep dive into a horror film, or in this case, a sci-fi TV show, and talk about how it connects to queerness, religion, and theology. My name is Pace Warfield May, and I am the clear influence that the source material had on the Star Wars franchise and many other franchises to follow.
Wow. Wow.
Okay. And I'm Pastor Emily, and I am the sand sculptures being simultaneously created and dissolving.
Well, I'm Lenny Duncan. I'm visiting, and I am actually a gleeman, or a historian, or a bard, which will be soon to be the most dangerous person on Earth.
Love it.
All right. So listeners, we have Lenny Duncan back with us. Who uses they/them pronouns. Lenny is a writer, speaker, scholar, and media producer working at the forefront of racial justice in America. Lenny is the author of Dear Church and United States of Grace, and co-creator of the podcast Blackberry Jams with PRX, a PhD student in historical and cultural studies of religion. Lenny is currently investigating the theft of African spiritual thought by white American esotericism. Lenny is originally from West Philadelphia, has hitchhiked thousands of miles on American byways, and now makes their home in Oakland, California. And we are so excited to have you with us today to talk about your new book, Dear Revolutionaries, and this amazing show, Foundation. How are you today?
I am well. Thank you for having me on the show. You know, it's weird to be like the Tuesday before like a book launch. It's like the third one. Or like, cause you know, Tuesday's the book launch. It's like the weekend before, and like, you know, I remember like Dear Church. You know, I was hustling, right? Like, I was doing every interview I could. I was doing all the book events. Anybody who booked me for a podcast. And this time, I'm like, I'm going to Harbin, and I'm turning my phone off, and I really don't care. And I think like the book has a lot of that. Like, hey, there's an industry behind this. There are people like me who are vultures. I have been part and parcel of it because there's very few way for Black, queer, and trans theologians and thinkers to exist. But by naming it, I've really made this book launch hard because I can't really do all the things that you normally do in a book launch when you write a book like that, right?
Yeah.
So if I say I don't want to be part of the thought leader industrial complex, if I say I don't want to like add to the increasingly gross rhetoric between people, if I say I want to make sure that like I keep a secret republic of the people to go, you know what I mean? All these things, right? Well, you can't really do a bunch of conferences and talk about how with just 3 days with you can solve the world's problems.
Yeah.
So I'm in a weird place. I think I'm in the place that Baldwin talks about. He says you can either be famous or you can write. And, you know, I wrote my first book, and then probably around my second, I really liked the visibility and that people knew my name and you know, people recognize me in stores and all that stuff. And I think, you know, this book and the one that's coming out in January is really, I've been spending a lot of time just learning to write again. And a lot of that means abandoning a lot of what I thought I was right about. So like, if, you know, and I'll shut up with this, like, what's interesting about this new book is I rip every book I've ever written to shit. Like, I'm merciless with myself. And I didn't expect that.
I was surprised when I first started reading it and like chapter one, here's a quote from Dear Church. And I was like, yeah, I remember reading it. I would like, this are the things that I connect with. And then you're like, and this is why it's bullshit. Okay. I'm here for it. But yeah.
Yeah. It's, you know, I'm open to the fact that like, the more I know, like, you know, that means like, really, like, the truth is like, the less I know, or the less I'm willing, I hate that. But like, the more I know, the less I'm like, committed to holding on to constructs or to the idea that I'm right. Mm-hmm. And I'm more in touch with, I was as right as I possibly could have been at that time.
Yeah.
You know, and now I have some more things to say about it. And I'm, you know, it would be hard for me to say every pastor, well, some of the things I say about being a pastor, right? And not, mm-hmm. and not cut myself to shreds. That would be very unfair, right? Because I start out the book by saying that, like, at a critical time in this world's history, faith leaders of all stripes, of all politics, of all denominations, of almost faiths, really failed humanity at a critical juncture. And I was part of that. And so I can't, you know what I mean? Like, I can't be like, oh, well, I was the one exception. That doesn't make sense. Everyone else is doing one thing, but I'm the one person who was justified. That's probably delusional. Right. Yeah. But then I have to come on shows with people like you, I love, who are good pastors and defend these things that I say.
But it's real, right? Like, and that's, I think, this beautiful place and part of what is so queer about this, right, is that it is saying and reminding people that it is not, we are always good and right, or we are always bad and wrong. And like, as a 5 on the Enneagram, that's a very difficult thing for me to like get past. Mm. And also I know it's true, right? That like, the truth is we are always growing and we are doing the best we can with where we're at and what we've got and what we know. The goal is to keep growing, to keep learning, to keep doing better because we're knowing better, and knowing better because we're doing better. But without that space to say, like, I fucked up, I didn't do it right, then there's no space for growth.
Absolutely. Too. Absolutely. But
Which maybe takes us a little bit into foundation territory.
Pace, let me ask you something. As someone who's had a relationship, a faithful, in various stages of I follow, I lead, I don't know if I want to lead. Okay, I'm following again, leading again, like all that stuff, right? I mean, one of the things, because I'm interested, because you've always been very neutral anytime we've like kind of interacted about my work. I mean, do you think I make a good case that actually institutional worship of any time is in the way of that? It's sort of like, that's why we keep kind of running into the same problems, that really the problem is when we gather and institutionalize these things that everyone should be able to do. Or do you disagree with that notion? Or do I make a good argument?
No, I you make a great argument for it. And it's one of the things that I find very refreshing about the Revolutionaries, is that that you are not scared to name the ways in which, like, just by interacting with the institution of church and the way that the church uses theology, spirituality, and liturgy is a way of upholding the institution and its powers and principalities. So like, I'm vibing mm-hmm. with that 100%. And that's one of the reasons why, like you said, I have this weird on again, off again relationship with the church, because I find myself getting sucked up into that too. I'm working at a church right now. It's weird. It's hard.
Pays the bills.
Enormous. Yeah, it pays the bills, but it's like one of those things at what cost?
So. Right. And like, and you want to do good, right, too? Because like, I want kids like me to see people like me doing stuff like that. Right? But like, how do you do that? And how do you do it with any integrity? So I was just, I'm very interested in how actual people doing the work here, the book, too, not just like, it's not just rah, rah, let's all get your pastor. Although there are a couple chapters, which.
And I guess we're probably just jumping all around for this episode, but I have not finished the book because I was trying simultaneously to finish the book and watch all the episodes of Foundation.
Oh, so man.
Pace went more book and I went more Foundation and we didn't get all of the things. But there is this – I love this space that is opened in it to like, here's a practice that you can do for yourself to help engage in this and connect you not just to yourself, but to the larger community of revolutionaries. Mm. And like, I think about that and I think about the way I, as a pastor who is currently serving two congregations, the spaces that I do my own thing, whether it's podcasting or like Diakonia.Faith Collective stuff, is such a beautiful space of connection and resistance because it's not beholden to what is proper Episcopal liturgy, what is proper Lutheran liturgy, those sorts of things. And there's just this like beautiful openness and freedom there for people to see people like you and people like me being leaders.
Mm.
And you that's in like y'all, yeah. You're and included
that,
pace.
And that brings us to the foundation, right? Which is like... a really fun show. So do you guys have the stats for that? Like, what do you guys have, like the description of the show that Apple TV uses? But I think it's, let me see if I can get it. It's really funny because we know, you know, I mean, well, you guys talk about your show, but I'm excited to talk about it. That's why I picked it. So I want to hear what you guys thought of the show.
I'm excited for it. I really liked it. I love outer space things. It reminded me of The Expanse, especially like the opening credits stuff, like just visually reminded me of The Expanse, but it also like reminded me some of The Expanse.
Where it like kind of reminds you that like, wow, actually, if you're paying attention to physics, we might not ever be able to reach another galaxy ever because some of them are moving faster than light away from us and all kinds of other weird fucking things that are happening in the universe, right? And so, it does have that sense of like, wow, space is big and fucking weird and not so like, you know, it's just, I like that about it. Oh man. I like how, it focuses on science, like how it's science that leads to this existential crisis. So, how would you describe the show? I mean, if to your list, because I don't want to do all that. I mean, I will.
I would describe the show, I mean, science, sci-fi dystopia.
Yeah.
In which everything is super polarized and authoritarian.
Yeah.
With small pockets of well-intentioned resistance. I haven't figured out if well-intentioned resist is enough.
Oh man, listen, how about that? The resistance fighters, like at one minute you're like, wow, that's so awesome, and then the next minute you're like, these people are despicable and I can't root for them anymore. Right. I mean, it's weird. So like, if you know, it's Isaac Asimov. And if you don't know the story, if there's listeners who don't know the story, it's basically this guy named Harry Seldon. He's a mathematician, and he comes up with this thing called psychohistory, and he's able to predict what large groups of people are able to do, right? Which is actually not science fiction; it's science fact. That's actually part of
I was going to say that's mathematics. And,
yeah, exactly. That's what historians do. That's what neurologists do. Some of the work that I'm doing at the GTU in historical and cultural studies of religion, and specifically around new religious movements. I mean, you can predict what people will do. Like, I'm at Harbin here, right? There's less than 2,000 people, I think, who live in this valley full time. But if it went to 20,000 people, within 5 years, I could tell you exactly what they would do, left to their own devices with no government or structure around them. And there were certain things that they would just predictably do, right? And so, I guess in that fact, but it really takes it to a whole new level where Harry predicts the fall of a 10,000-year empire that stretches galaxies. Mm-hmm. And it is run by the clones of the first emperor, Cleon the First, mm-hmm. who cloned themselves, and then their brother Dawn, who's around 6 years old, seven, he's the youth. Then there's brother Day, who's the one who runs the empire itself. And then there's brother mm-hmm. Dusk, who is the wise elder. But they're all three the same person, re-educating themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's fascinating. And the, like, the ways that religion and religiosity and religious language is just, like, throughout, like, in the names where, like, literally, because you say it's about Harry Seldon, and I, as someone who did not read the books, am like, no, it's about Gale and Salvor.
Oh, yeah. Oh, like, it's about Salvador Haldin and Gale. But they're in the quandary which is very interesting, right? That the showrunners decided to use two black women for those characters, but keep mm-hmm. Harry white. So it's like, so once again, we have these two kind of extraordinary black women characters, who are caught in a problem created by a white person, right? 30,000 mm-hmm. years in the future, except they do these really like counterintuitive things. They don't try to be the hero. They don't suffer for everyone, and they don't make the smart choices or the political choice or the most expedient choices. So then, you know, you have all these characters kind of moving counterintuitively to how we expect them in a narrative, which I find so fascinating. The showrunners decide to do it, but of course it pissed off all the white boy fans. The biggest fans of this story who have been the biggest fans who've been the fans of the story have been Elon Musk really loves the foundation. He really likes it. And so does Bezos. Bezos really likes the foundation.
Well, okay.
Now, the reason why is because the story itself focuses on the fall of the empire. But for those guys, mm-hmm. they think about the 10,000 years that led up to it.
Mm.
They think about the expansion of that empire when it first started. They think about the faster than light messaging, because we don't need faster than light travel to change reality. We only need faster than light messaging, because any reply we would receive it in the past. So the mm-hmm. past would be able to re-engineer the now and thus change the future. I mean, that's the physics behind mm-hmm. it, right? Mm-hmm. And so, like, you know, like, so that's what these guys are looking for. So these ideas where the future can be predicted by studying the past, and it's these expansive futures full of corporate and trading and spacing guilds and conglomerates.
Mm-hmm.
But you notice at the end of the vision what kind of people always seem to be on top. And so what I really like about this is that the Apple writers were smart enough to know we have to play with the characters. We cannot have a vision that black people don't exist in, that Asian folks don't exist in, that indigenous folks don't exist in. They were smart enough to do it, but they were smart enough not to telegraph it. Like the one planet full of hunters that comes, right? And faces Salvador Hardin, mm-hmm. right? All of them are clearly Persian, Farsi, mostly actors, right? They're Persian, there's a Palestinian actor amongst them, like, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. There's a few Egyptian acts. So clearly they're giving you an idea of a culture. You know what I mean? These peoples went to this planet and started this culture however many thousands of years ago, right? But they don't telegraph it, right? Yeah. And the fact that the writers were able to look at the source material, because Isaac Asimov wasn't thinking like that. He was thinking it was like him and all his suburban friends.
Mm-hmm.
But I just love how people could take good source material, not really change the plot line, right? Which is what the right always accuses people of wokeism and changing the plot line. Really, all you're doing mm-hmm. is changing a few key things. Like, they change the fact that you're used to just seeing futures of white. That's it. Salvador Haldin, still the same character. You know what I mean? They're all still the same characters.
Yeah. And even the language, right? The way the two languages for Anacreon and Thespian languages are give you a sense of a culture that is consistent with that, right? That I don't know if it's a made-up language or if it's actually like a real language, but it feels like it is based more in Arabic for Anacreon and more in like the Slavic language families for Thespian.
Yeah.
And as like a language nerd, I love that. I love that I can get a hint of who this is in this made up world.
Exactly. And they, and it's really because what's that place the emperor as? Does that make that the Caucasus Mountains? Is that what that makes the empire? Mm-hmm. And does that make that the beginning? You know what I mean? Of like, like it's a really, because that's a really interesting, as a language nerd myself, like that's a really interesting point, right? We know that the first like white or European Muslims were from the Caucasus Mountains. We know that from that area, a lot of there was this exchange during the Dark Ages that sort of like saved Europe, you know what I mean? And brought them back their own Bible and shit because they had burned them all. And like, but that came from white bodied people who had been trained by Muslims and Moors and other travelers and traders. And it's just really interesting that they might be playing with the idea, you know what I mean, of of the empire being situated in this really unique way. It's weird that they wear blue. When you think about blue blood, the emperor wears nothing but blue.
I associated that with blue being a bright and vibrant color. You have to dye it. And like historically, blue purple is the most expensive, but royal blue is royal blue because it was expensive and rare.
Yes.
And this isn't like, they don't wear royal blue, but they wear like.
Yeah. Yeah. They, fancy color. Yeah. It's intense. That's like one of the intense things. What do you think about the normal people though, who like are going along for the ride?
Yeah. It's like, weird.
Yeah. Like why? I don't get it. I don't get the buy-in for some people.
I get the buy-in to the foundation because presumably the empire is leaving out the vast majority of people. Like the vast majority of people are getting overlooked, are getting oppressed, are getting like economically don't have enough, all of that stuff. And then there's this chance for something different. And this person who is saying not one stone will be left on another.
Yeah, they typically kill people for that. Saying something like that, like I'll tear this temple down in 3 days or some shit. People don't feel that shit.
Yeah, and so, but like that's the compelling thing. Right? Yeah. The compelling thing is like, even if you're gonna die for it, there is another option. There is a possibility for something else. And the complicated part is that like the way that the foundation is framed is like this is to help the empire, like fall more gently.
Right.
and I'm not, because I haven't watched the last episode, and maybe even then I wouldn't know, but like I'm not actually clear on how much Harry Seldon is like anti-empire and how much he wants to help the empire like fall slowly and rebuild quickly, or if like he just is like, or like is he actually against the empire and the oppression of the empire?
Like he may be the cause. Well, I mean, if you listen to Harry, he's just following history. He's just looking at the patterns, right? Yeah. So he's just having a common response to a, you know, he's having a rational response to an irrational world in an irrational situation, right? But I don't think that's true. I think Harry realizes that it's not, because I mean, you know, at one point, you know, they say this, they're like, oh, everything's not locked in, because you remember that's how Salvador Hardin even exists, because things are changed, right? And so Salvador Hardin is now playing a different role, right? And so they don't know how to do it, right? And they don't have all the pieces they need, and they can't quite figure it out, right? And so that kind of proves that like Harry, not that Harry doesn't know everything, but he might be more of a causality than he's letting on.
Well, and the ways that an individual does drastically change things. He's like, oh, I can't predict anything except for mass movements of people. And then he's like, but I have to die so I become a martyr.
Right. Like,
but Raish has to go here and Gale has to go there.
But whoops, I messed it up.
oops.
I think that was Asimov trying to say. I think that was Asimov. Because Harry is really a metaphor for Asimov as a writer, right? Mm. And so, you know, you're doing this world building. And, you know, and Asimov is starting to see, like, some of the things from science fiction become science fact. You're starting to see that, you know, that people who talk about things like, you know, like a great example of that is, like, most of our research in FTL is because a bunch of kids watch Star Trek. And you're like, well, how's that helpful? Well, how about the nuclear fusion we just got 3 weeks ago, folks? Right? That gives us clean, unlimited energy for life. Right? Like, these are the kind of things that happen as a result of a dreaming of futures, right? And believing that we're capable of much more than most people believe we're capable of. And I think Harry really plays as a metaphor for that for Asimov throughout the entire book, where it's like, hey, I see these big things coming, but I'm a shitty person. And you're like, yeah, we know, Isaac. You know, it's cool. Right? Like, you're a human being. Mm-hmm. It's, like, beyond, like, any power construct or, like, why, you know, or even laying aside the matrix of power that is Colonnade, right? Laying all that stuff aside, just being human, right? We know you can render the most beautiful pieces of art and not be that great of a person sometimes. It just happens. And so I think in that way, Harry becomes this character where it's like, well, you know, it's okay for us to have these figures, these metaphors, these leaders who help us dream of great big things. And then when you get close to them, you realize that they're just as human as you. Right? I think he's trying to play with that, which as a writer, I'm writing some fiction now and pitching a few movies and a few shows rather than books. Mm-hmm. And as a writer, like, I understand that. I understand wanting to put one character in the story that is you but isn't you. In other terms, it holds the place for that person telling the story. I think Harry does a lot of that. That's why the action he does is not really action, right? Mm. Every time Harry's involved in the action, they can't stop what's happening. Yeah. Not even him.
Right. It's when Gale intervenes that there's a, like, okay, it's going in this direction. Or when Salvor intervenes that it shifts direction. Yeah.
Right. So that's the funny thing is that Harry not only is a witness to his own death and what's going to happen to the old empire, but then as this hologram is now the witness to see if he was right or not, unable to change any of it. Mm-hmm. That's what being a writer is.
I do think it's interesting, though, the one piece that, like, so for me, a lot of this is like this mathematical mysticism.
Yes. I love it.
Right. Which is so beautiful, like, as a math nerd. It is so gorgeous. And part of how they do it is with the box thing and the sand and then, like, making these images that are, like, super complex mathematical equations. But there's this, like, mathematical mysticism while Harry Seldon is about also mathematical rationality, right? Like, used what he's saying and doing is rational. And it's like, okay, but that's only ever described for white people. Only white men are ever rational.
Right, right.
And so then when we can, like, break that open and be like, actually, it's not about the rational. There is this whole movement for mysticism and mathematical mysticism that then comes in conflict with other religions, particularly the religion on Synax, right, where they could work together. They could be symbiotic. And Gale is a perfect example of that, right? She has the power of sight.
Yeah.
And it is like they try to take it from her and are about to, like, kill her because she also understands the value of math and science and the way it makes sense of the world, and understands that as a gift from the seer as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, but that's too a far. Really, no, that's yeah. a really, that's a really interesting point. I mean, like, that's it. I mean, some of the work I'm doing in history, right, is called impact history. And, like, it's land-based narratives looking at different places where cultures impacted each other, but not treating it like how decolonial, like, historians have treated it, where, like, the empire is all powerful or anything like that. But separate ontological realities, doors and points where these realities exist, and monistic dualities, simultaneity of each other, like, you know, the ability of us to tap into multiple realities, not only within us, not only around us, but just knowing that these indigenous sciences, you know, are just being proved more and more true. I mean, that's what I see down at Berkeley. More and more, I've got physicists and historians and other people who come to my psychedelic research group where, you know, they want to get dosed by us and stuff. Like some of the guys who are working on, like, you know, the fusion and other things, or they're at least curious about, you know, what we're seeing in comparison to what they're seeing in the universe, right? Yeah. And so, yeah, I think you're right. I think it is a good vision of, like, what does it mean when the mystic meets the mass medical? What does it mean when the seer meets science? What does it mean when math meets, you know what I'm saying? Like a metamorphosis. And that's where our future lies, you know?
Yeah.
So,
and that's another interesting parallel to your book too, is the importance you put of,
look at Pace keeping us on track too.
Pace, you're the best.
Well, but I just love, no, I love how there's the connection to ancestral work as in and of itself this kind of waging peace and being accountable to one's past and present as a way of also kind of projecting or building a future. Like this, for listeners, I'm sorry, I'm gonna use a big theology word, but like this teleological pool that the past, that accessing the past is able to access the future in a sense. And I just really love that in both the Show Foundation and your book, and how that kind of is this propelling force into justice work, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I talk a lot about ancestral work in the new book just because, like, you know, if you've ever visited another country, you're like, why do I feel so relaxed here? Well, that's mostly because there's not tens of thousands of screaming, murdered ancestors floating above your head. And there isn't, like, this sense of, like, lack of relationship with land. There may be a sense of history, a sense of dominionism, or even a sense of, like, heritage. But there's always some sort of relationship with land, which Americans hardly ever have.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, for me, I think part of, you know, that big theological word you talked about, Pace, teleological or progressive views of time, that, you know, the past meets the present meets the future, is that they rely on a Western Enlightenment view of progressivism or progress, that we are progressing towards some future where everything's going to work out. When the evangelicals think that, like, someone's going to step in who's divine and change all that for us. And a lot of other folks believe that, like, we'll come up with it somehow, right? And all of that's just, like, such part of the project of colonialism. And so that's why I talk a lot about the past engineering the future, that our ancestors have the technologies we need, that they are communicating with us, and that our hope doesn't come from some future event. It actually lies in our past. And that those beings are alive, and that time and space are just as malleable as the means of communication I use for them, right? But you can't say that in the beginning of the book. You have to say, like, have you ever tried?
Work your way towards it.
Yeah, have you ever tried All Saints Sunday, Grandma? Okay, we're almost there.
But that's also interesting, too, and I feel like a very stunning critique of the church that reading your book really helped me see, and I'm so grateful for this, in the ways in which the ELCA, as the widest mainline denomination, in the mergers and all of that erasing of its history and predecessor bodies to create this generic white church, as opposed to the more unique various Scandinavian and German churches that had their own cultural identities, theological language, as a way of the church cozying up to empire and becoming empire itself.
Oh, I mean, that's the thing, right? In the exchange for what we get as Americans first, I want to say that. And then what we get in exchange, or what some of us get in exchange for either being accepted into whiteness or our proximity to whiteness. And I certainly have a proximity to it. I've got class, right? And I have high class privilege because of education, right? It's not always money, right? And so, like my proximity to whiteness, right? Like how I'm attached to that, right? But like certainly we gain something in that exchange. And one of the things that we gain is that, like, if we give up culture, if we give up our land-based thing, if we give up our thing, where we're from, we get safety, right? It's part of the illusion of safety, right? That that every inch of this country has been searched and explored. It's been conquered. And not only that, but there is a police force who can get to you in 15 minutes. And that, yeah, you know what I mean? But it's not real. Like, if you've ever driven mm-hmm. across this country, you know, none of that's real, right?
Yeah, yeah. But even in, like, when I think about the ELCA, it's not just that, like, everything got pushed together in a race, but also that it got pushed together in such a way that there is no way to actually navigate it, right? That when you take a top-down structure and a bottom-up structure and smash them together and don't, like, pick and choose intentionally which one is the best polity, you get this thing that literally we don't even have a polity class because it would be too confusing. Well, it would not, like,
yeah, I mean, thing. Merging a top-up and a bottom-up position sounds great for an orgy, but not so great for polity, right? I mean, right? Not so great for an institution, yeah. Right? That sounds like who you invite to the party, right? But not how you want to live your life. And yeah, there's just mm-hmm. a lot of that, man. Like, you know, but and listen, I think it's church as a whole. They're going to have mm-hmm. to really wrestle with the fact that the name Jesus Christ fills about 40% of this country full of fear. When it's said.
Yeah.
And how do you overcome that? And you can't continue to overcome it by creating a smaller and smaller and a more angry minority. I mean, you could break the country that way and possibly come up with like 3-4 states that agree with you or some shit like that. But that's about mm-hmm. it, right? We know that the Union, as we know it, fated to fall the next 20 years. Like, we know it'll probably break into 3 different whatever the fucks, right? If not more. And there's people vying, you know. Sarah Huckabee Sanders was not running mm-hmm. for president of the United States. She was running for leader of whatever the fuck they're going to make in 10 years. Her and all her friends. And so mm-hmm. they've had it with us. And frankly, I think a lot of us have had it with them. And, you know, part of that is, though, is like when you know that sort of thing's going to happen, you know, like what can you offer to people? And I think what's really interesting is that the reason I chose this is because, you know, I wrote Dear Revolutionaries starting like May 25th of 2020. And I really went out there just to be a chaplain, you know, in front of Portland. And, you know, if you read Dear Church, you know, I was very convinced that if we just got people together, we spoke to them rationally, you know, shit would work, right? But what I didn't count on is that some people just want to watch the world fucking burn because they don't like the way it's going. What mm-hmm. I didn't count on is the fact that the people that I would be going to serve didn't need shit from me. And in fact, I should be sitting there, I should be listening, and I should be following them because they're probably the closest to the divine I'd ever see. I didn't know I'd bury so many comrades. You know, mm-hmm. the beginning of the book is dedicated to people we buried on my watch. I live with that. You know, choices I made. And when you know, they call it, the ancients called it the obscure night. You know, it's when everything you think you knew about reality, you thought you knew about yourself, you thought you knew about magic or the Holy Spirit or Ashe, or it's when it all melts and you're left with nothing. And that's where I was. And so I wrote, or, you know, I the reason I wanted to watch the foundation while we talked about it is because it's very much a book written for when shit gets worse. It's very much a book written for mm-hmm. when you can't leave your home again for 3 years. How do you bury your own dead? When you can't leave your home because it's too dangerous, how do you have a holy gathering of people? When things fall apart in your neighborhood, how do you make sure everyone gets fed? And it can't be everyone go to the Baptist church on Thursday, you fucking world full of dum-dums. I mean, do you know what I mean? Like, you know, and, mm-hmm. and part of that is getting to know people. And getting relationship with them, you know, and knowing, because that was the interesting thing, is that as things progressively got worse in Portland, as we watched the sitting president of the United States get suggestions on Fox and Friends, then try them on us later, as we watched federal agents kidnap faith leaders, as my presiding bishop, Elizabeth Eaton at the time, fucking gaslit me and pretended like none of it was happening, yeah. right? And then waited till the Times came out with everything and then said, oh, well, no. We understand that you're kind of damaged from all that. Yeah, you understand that now, huh? And so, like, yep. you know, all those things, right? Like when I was in the moment of that, you know, like, those were the things that really held us together. It was the fact that, like, people set aside politics when things fall apart. People who even set aside faith. People who even set aside what they think they thought they knew about you and what they think they thought they knew about you before they even met you. Mm-hmm. And you know what happens is the good people run towards the shit and helps people and the bad people run away. It's a really easy way to figure out who's who. Mm-hmm. And even some of the ones who run away just want to create space so they can catch up. But they're all part of that, right? They're part of that movement towards the point of pain, towards the world of crime, towards where the blood is, towards where the fear is, to offer love, consolation, hope, and healing rather than ensconcing ourselves in spiritual places like I am now, away from it all, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Sorry, ranty.
Nah, you're bringing me back to 2020, and I have
right, yeah.
not revisited yeah, you, that in a while.
Well, you have, you don't ever talk about it, but I know. Like, I know people where you were. You were out there every day. You know, you're one of the few ELCA ministers I know. And there's only about 7 of us. I'm going to keep it real with you. Out of thousands who were out on a regular basis for various reasons. I understand some of us were immunocompromised. I understand everyone had the reasons. I'm not here to knock that. I'm here to talk about reality. Right? The reality is there's maybe 250 of us who are ancillary and chart, like, you know, connected to some of that stuff. But like, there were about a dozen of us who were out there every day for the heat of it, when people were being gunned down, when people were being murdered, when it was dangerous. And no one ever gets a chance to do this for me, but I want to thank you for what you did for the church and for this country. I'm proud to know you. We're not going to get a parade or anything. And like, the only way you know we did right is because, you know, 3 weeks ago the world didn't burn. That's how you know we did enough in 2020. And let's hope we do enough next time. But thank you for the way you showed up in the world.
It is a testament to the people I know and the people who cared about me and walked with me and talked with me, yourself included, right?
Yeah, we had the Dungeons and Dragons for... We had Dungeons and Dragons for activists who may die, which it was a really long campaign, too.
Yes, but we got an elephant out of it, so I was happy.
Yes, but that whole campaign, it was just all of us completely damaged from, like, service work around the country and then pretending together, which was so good. Ugh.
Yeah, creating a world that was not the world we were in every day.
I don't know. There was some mirror. There were some mirrors.
There was some, but it was not a default of all of the things that were harming us.
We need to do a new campaign. You know what? I'm going to call it right here. I'm really thinking about DMing my first dungeon, mistressing my first game. And yes, and I'll even put out what I think I'm going to do. I think it's going to be basically the premise is you wake up with like anything from like level 12 to level 20 powers, but you're a middle schooler.
Yes.
And like some suburban or some city place, and you've never heard of any of this shit, and the world starts getting weird, and you have to figure it out.
I love it. I'm here for it.
Do you know what I mean? So, you know, it's like, you can throw a lightning bolt up, but you better roll this 3-sided die to see if you don't mess it up and shoot like 5 of your friends. Like, you know what I mean? Like that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Oh, that would be brilliant.
Well, y'all.
That would be so refreshing, too.
Do y'all have any questions for me about the book? I feel like I hate book tours. God, if it wasn't you two, especially the week before, no way. But I love the show. I really do. it's fun. It's one of the only shows that doesn't come here and ask me to do a lot of emotional labor as a black organizer. It's one of the only ones. Everyone else asks me to come and do a ton of emotional labor, explain all the things to them. You guys are like, you want to watch Blade with us? And I'm like, yeah, I do.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Yeah, I do. What's your most, what movie are you excited coming out? Or have you been watching Wheel of Time or anything?
I have not. I've been rewatching, aside from the like pause for Foundation, I've been rewatching Doctor Who, and Pace gave me like a timeline to do Doctor Who, the old Doctor and the new and the like newer series, like somewhat concurrently, because I've never seen the old Doctors.
Oh, so Pace gave you all the places that the new Doctor revisited some of those storylines, so that way you can connect them and they feel a little bit more That's cool. That's a really cool. You should put that in the show notes, Pace. You should put that in the show notes, man, because I know exactly what I know how to make those connections, but that's only because I watched that stuff. I was broken, poor, and grew up in the projects. Doctor Who was one of the only sci-fi I got. It was free.
Yeah.
It was on PBS, and I could watch it as much as I wanted, you know? Oh, that, what's the other one? What's the other one where they're stuck on the ship? It's like three English guys who don't want to do their job, and they're stuck on a ship. What the hell is that?
Oh,
Red Dwarf.
Red Dwarf, yes.
Wait, were we just talking about Red Dwarf last night on our Facebook Live?
Maybe.
No.
No, Red Dwarf is so funny. It's just like four guys complaining about contemporary English politics, but in space. What the fuck is going on?
It's hilarious.
Oh, my God. So where are you at with the Doctor?
I'm still on season one. I just started. So I'm on season one, Christopher Eccleston. I'm most of the way through, I think. And then after that, I'll go back to, I think, the first Doctor?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That is probably if I would say, is there a character that's my archetype? That would be it. That would be
Christopher Eccleston?
No, just the Doctor in general.
Oh, just the Doctor. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Just that's real.
Although that could be, since church people love their Enneagram, we could just replace it with Doctor. Which Doctor number are you?
Instead of which Enneagram number?
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, I'm certainly Matt Smith.
I believe that. I can see it.
Yeah. Matt Smith was my first Doctor.
Grandpa vibes and young body, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly. Old man and young body. And then what I loved is that when she asked, why was, she was like, why was he in that body? And River Song says, he was flirting with you. Right? That he wore that, that he had enough foresight that he came up with that face, not for his companion at the time, but the next one. So he could pull them into the real dark stuff for the next one. Which ended up in her death, by the way. So what is the price for the Doctor's journeys? The companions. That's why he loves them so much. Because they're the price. That's why we all love the one blonde one, because Donna, she's the only one that hasn't died yet.
Donna's the best. I do love Donna. Right? I love Donna because Donna is ordinary. And there's an episode that we watched for, I think, our BooTube, right? Where Donna, the one where Donna has the bug on her back. And it's this
I know the episode.
And the Doctor, and the Doctor just had this in one of the episodes I watched recently too, of it is precisely those who are ordinary that are essential.
Exactly.
Right? And you can expand that in a whole lot of ways when we talk about essential workers.
Oh, man.
And who makes up, right? Dear Revolutionaries is not written to the fancy bishops and pastors and deacons.
No.
It's written to the ordinary revolutionaries.
I just like the Doctor's code. You know what I mean? Never petty or cruel. Mm-hmm. Right? what a code. Sorry.
No. Apology rejected.
All right, into that. I'm into that. Oh, man. Pace, how long have you been watching The Doctor? Come on, talk to me about it.
I got into Doctor Who through Torchwood, because Torchwood... when I was going through seminary, Torchwood was one of the only shows that had openly queer people showing their queerness, with Jack Harkness and Yanto and all that. So I watched that as it was coming out, and then I started watching Doctor Who as a result. So I watched the entire new series of Doctor Who right before the 11th Doctor, so I got concurrent with it, and then started watching it from the 11th Doctor on. And in between series, as they aired, I'd go back and watch the originals. So it took me 2 years, but in a 2 year span, I watched the entirety of the original Doctor Who series.
Okay. Yeah. But no, that's, Matt Smith.
I watched all of Doctor Who in 2 years.
Yeah, Matt Smith was my doctor too. I was really into that, man. Matt Smith was I saw the doctor right before him, the 11th Doctor. But something about Matt Smith, man, just that first episode, the cockiness, the trying to figure out who he is the whole time, right? Which is making fun of the fact that this was a BBC actor who had always played a bad boy and a goofball, And who was he to be this old character? And so he's like, the way the writers played with that, you know what I mean? It was just so cocky at the end when he throws on the tie. And he's like, because everyone expected him to be how he is in House of the Dragon. Because that's usually how he acts. That's usually who he is on BBC.
I had never seen him.
Oh, he's a huge. Oh, he's like all the guys at ABC from like all the cop shows and shit. He's just a guy who's always around. You know what I mean? And but when he got the doctor, it was a big deal. People were like, how is this dude who's never really played a nice and or moral person going to be the nicest, most moral person we have, you know? And he gilded that first episode. I mean, I loved it.
Yeah. So, and the reality that the doctor is not the nicest, most moral person necessarily. Like,
he made awful decisions throughout that. I think that still affect the doctor to this day.
Yeah.
Well, y'all, thank you for having me. I'm going to go soak now. I am at a hot springs.
That sounds so delicious. I'm envious.
Yeah, that sounds delightful.
Well, you have been delightful.
Yeah. Tell us, before you go, tell us I want to know what your rating of the series is. Out of 10, I don't know. Out of 10 what? What are we doing right now? We're between seasons.
Yeah.
The stones that they put in their face, out of 10 of those stones.
Out of 10 seer stones, how do you rate Foundation?
I would say season 1's a solid 7. And here's why. The source material has a lot more to go. You got to remember there's like 500 years more worth of history or something they have to tell or something. I really like what they did with Salvador Halden. I really liked how they showed the immensity of space. I really how they like to show the gamut now. But it took there were parts where it lingered in the middle because writers always assume that their audience is stupider than they are. And so we got like 2 episodes of like, hey, dummy, in case you don't get the point. And so I give it a 7.5. I think next season is going to be a solid 8 or 9. I think they have all the pieces in place to do really fast moving episodes where they tell decades worth of history at a time while watching Cleon stay unchi the entire time.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It is. There's a lot of world building that had to happen. And that takes some. I give it an 8 because I just love space. So, it can get better, but it's a solid 8. Like, we have black holes, space. We have outer space, we've got it all.
Yeah. I would give it a 7 too, just because world building is exhausting for me. But I do think that once season 2 it gets its stride, I'm excited to see where it goes. But before you head out, where can our listeners find you? Where can they pick up a copy of Dear Revolutionaries for themselves? All those amazing things.
Yeah, so I love saying this now. I'm finally at the point where I can say this, is that you can get a copy of Dear Revolutionaries at any major retailer in America or any local bookstore. You can order it anywhere. Awesome. You know, of course, I always ask you to pre-order at your independent local bookstore. I know that Target usually carries me, you know, all the monsters, Amazon. I shouldn't say that. They'll find me. But, you know, they all carry me. Barnes & Noble carries me. Goodreads can show you a bunch of places to get it. And then I always tell people to check out IndieBound, because IndieBound will send you directly to a local bookstore that carries my book. I have a Substack called A Sorcerer's Notebook that's over at Substack at LennyAduncan.com. And that's sort of where a lot of my work is. My dissertation work is called A People's History of Magic. And, you know, The Sorcerer's Notebook is just a book. It's a Sorcerer's Notebook because I'm not pretentious. And and basically it's like, are you thinking about, did you feel something happen in, say, March of 2020 and you started to get more into Earth-based practices over the last couple of years? Interesting. Well, would you like a notebook full of things of some idiot who made all the mistakes for you in almost every magical way? Why, I'm that idiot, and please read my notebook. So please subscribe. It's always free. It's always free. I ask that you subscribe if you can, but I never charge for posts. So you can subscribe. It always helps me when you subscribe. Helps more if you pay, and I lowered the subscription fee to like, I think, like $6.99 a month or some shit, $9.99. I made it a lot lower.
It's still less than a New York Times subscription that gets you terrible op-eds.
Yes, like, yes. But at least they crank out material, right? I'm very slow. Last thing I wrote about was I'm doing a conference on psychedelics, and I pitched, and they actually, they I'm doing this talk now, but it's the colonization of the astral plane and the ethics of plant medicine. And so that's the last thing I wrote about is that how, like, you know, hey guys, you guys think you found some new groovy thing? Guess what? These assholes have been standing around waiting for you since 62. And there's nothing new here. This is well explored, well exploited capitalist territory. And we need to be very aware. That doesn't mean it doesn't have anything to teach us. That doesn't mean it can't help a lot of people. We need to be very aware of what they're doing with this over the next couple of years, because, you know, with this this discovery of free, endless energy, that means capitalism's over in the next 50 years. So now they have to find another means of control. And it might be your mind, and it might be your wellness.
I mean, right now they're coming for wellness, for sure.
Yep. And wellness is a big part of it. So, you know, so I write about that. And I write about all that kind of stuff. Also, I teach how to do glyphs and stuff, how to do black sorcery against corporations to curse them forever, all kinds of fun shit. You know, just check it out.
Are UNL, I know UNL just did, or maybe are just finishing up, a class, and I was really excited about it, and then had family emergency stuff come up right when it was about to start. But are you going to do that again, maybe?
We are. After book launch, probably about a month or so, we're going to announce that we're going to do another Waging Peace cohort. The last one went really well. It was a great experience. We've got some retooling to do, but I brought actually had a consultant come in and follow everything we were doing and kind of give me back a game plan that we can more effectively I'm leaning into my gifts. Elle's leaning into their gifts, and like the class gets to show their gifts. And so but real soon.
Nice.
I'll be leading another class real soon, and then pretty soon I'll be teaching over at Cal. You can audit.
Nice.
Yep. Next spring, you can audit A People's History of Magic through Graduate Theological Union or Cal, or like a dozen other schools in that conglomerate.
Nice. That's awesome.
Yep. Well, I'm going to go. Y'all are the best. I love y'all.
We love you too, Lenny. You're amazing. Thank you so much for being on. It's always
You guys are good luck. You guys are good luck every time. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
Yep. Okay. Right.
Well, that's it for our show. Our theme music was by Matt May. Horror Nerds at Church releases every Thursday. Please comment, rate, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Support us on Patreon and get access to exclusive movie commentary episodes, BooTube episodes, and more bonus content by going to patreon.com/horrornerdsatchurch. It's only $5 to sign up, cheaper than a hyper jump through space.
100%.
It's called? Maybe? Follow us on social media, Facebook and Instagram at Horror Nerds at Church, and Twitter at HNACPOD for all the latest updates and about upcoming films, news, and other announcements. Until next time.
Buy a copy of Lenny's book.
Yeah, until next time.
Or get it from your library.
That's what I was going to say. Request your library to buy a copy of Dear Revolutionaries, and buy a copy for yourself if you can. But you can request the library to buy it without having to spend the money yourself if you don't have that money to spend. And if you do, then also buy a copy and give your library a copy. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
Yay, books.